because Representative Chair Comp is not feeling very well, so she, I think she'll be here, but not in this seat. And I am going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2039. So we're going to start a little out of order. And
2039.
Yeah.
We have the list there.
Let me get the list.
Do we have our administrator review the bill?
Yes. Yeah. Okay, I'm going to ask the committee administrator to review the bill.
Thank you, Chair. 2039 basically defines a small school, establishes that statutes and rules that are generally applied to school districts or public schools do not apply to these newly defined small schools, but does establish that federal law and certain other statutes do apply to the new small schools. Currently, all public schools, regardless of size, must adhere to federal, state, and education laws with the exception of public charter schools. And then attached to this, I also did put a copy of the ORS that apply primarily to the statute, so they're just there for your review.
Thank you. And I'm going to call to the testimony stand here Mark Jeffrey and Peter Tarzian. The gentleman will state your name and occupation for the record. Either of you can start. You want to go ahead?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Mark Jeffrey. I'm superintendent and principal for Paisley School District in Paisley, Oregon. We're a small 80-student K-12 district serving the communities of Paisley and Summer Lake.
And my name is Peter Tarzian, and I am the superintendent of the Falls City School District, which is west of here, about 25 miles. Falls City is a K-12 district that has approximately 175 students.
Thank you. And Mark, why don't you go ahead with your testimony?
Thank you. As I mentioned, I represent Paisley School District. I'm also here on behalf of Oregon's 12 smallest K-12 districts, of which Jordan Valley is our largest of our group. It has about 103 students, and our smallest right now is, I think, Long Creek with about 27 students, and those are K-12 districts. All of these districts that I represent are located on the east side of the mountains, most of them in a general circle around the John Day area, with the two outliers being Paisley and Jordan Valley. I've been a superintendent for about 6 years, and on my first official day in Paisley, I left a lucrative teaching position at the middle school in Lakeview and stepped up, or I guess moved over to the dark side and became an administrator in Paisley. And on my first official day, I received a letter from the Department of Education discussing an adjustment to our March estimate that the district and previous superintendent had built the budget on. And being new, I wasn't sure what it meant, so I took it to her because, of course, your business managers in small districts know everything, and they really do. And she looked at it for about half an hour and said, came back and said, "Well, this is really bad news." And I said, "Well, how bad is really bad?" She said, "Well, they're adjusting our estimate downward by $100,000. And in a $1.7 million budget, that was pretty large. Again, that was in July of 2001. And as you know, with September 11th and the economic reverberations that occurred to the state's budget, we were put in a fairly significant financial slide, as were most of the districts in Oregon. And yet, as one of Oregon's smallest and most fragile, it impacted us most directly. We did everything that most districts do in those circumstances. We looked at making cuts to positions and to programs where most, of course, a district's expenses are. And then as a final effort, we took a look at becoming the first single school district to go charter, which we did. And I can honestly say that it was that move to charter that has allowed me to still be here today. I'm completely convinced that without our attaining charter status for our district, Paisley would have closed within a year or two of that of my taking the position. And that's not what you want on your resume under reasons for leaving last job, as I killed the district. So I'm here to advocate for HB 2039 because I realize that Certainly, and honestly, I'll tell you the reason we first pursued charter was that there was about $350,000 of federal grant money that seemed like a real similar number to what I was cutting out of my little budget. We knew that was temporary funding, and so we and knew that we had a responsibility to keep our school alive, and that's what we went after. However, as we got into the process, what we also found out is that the flexibility that are allowed under Oregon's charter legislation to be free from some of the rules and regulations that all Oregon districts are held to has given us the opportunity to be innovative and to be efficient. One of the things that we are frequently as districts asked to do is to find more efficiencies. And in small districts where there are no... not a lot of leeway in a budget that small, it's hard to find those, especially when you're asked to maintain programs in keeping with your larger urban districts in Oregon. A very difficult thing to do. And what charter status allowed us to do, even after the money went away, was to continue to operate as efficiently as possible. Now, I'm not saying that 2039 is an end-all. It's not a silver bullet. It's not going to solve all our problems, but it has allowed us to efficiently use the limited funding that we have. It's the reason we're still here and the reason we're going to be here into the future. There's a conception that on the part of some that with more rules and statutes, without more rules and statutes, it's difficult to ensure accountability. But in all honesty, certainly in our small districts, I'm not primarily held accountable by the Division 22 standards or state laws. I'm held accountable by my parents and my students and my community. Mm-hmm. They let me know on a regular basis what we're doing well and what we're not doing well, and those are the primary reasons we make the adjustments we make. And the folks in my community and in my district, in Summer Lake and in Paisley, have really seen that an improvement in what we've been able to offer. Through charter, we were able to purchase new textbooks. We have a cattle operation that our FFA students are involved in. We have a rainbow trout breeding program that our natural resource science kids are involved in. We have a low-power FM radio station that serves the community. It's the only one that you can effectively get. And, in fact, our first interview was the governor of the state of Oregon and the first lady. That was kind of a great way to start things off. So we have seen enhancements brought about partially by those dollars, certainly, but also by the flexibility that we've been able to build into the system by focusing on what we can do right. We can't do everything. The small districts can't. It's impossible. There's not the base of students to provide the funding to do that. It's very challenging, but we are able to meet those challenges and still provide an exceptional education for our students. One of the other misconceptions out there is that small districts, certainly charter districts, one of the things that circulated through our community until we were able to answer it well, is that you limit opportunities for your students in the upper division education. Right now, we have students who have either attended or are currently attending all of Oregon's four-year institutions, three of the community colleges. I have two students, one who graduated the year before we went charter and one who graduated that the year before that. One of those is at Berkeley Graduate School, and the other is at one of those little-known eastern colleges called Yale, attending graduate school there. So we provide a really quality education. We still do. It gets more challenging each year, but again, that challenge is somewhat remediated with the assistance we have and the flexibility we have by not having to do things that we can't effectively do and focus our efforts on those things that we know we can do and improving on those.
Superintendent, I think there's a question.
Sure.
Mark, did you define the term remote and necessary?
I can.
Please.
Sure. What we look at in the remote and necessary districts are those districts that are at least 30 miles to the next nearest school. In my case, I'm 50 miles from North Lake and 45 to Lakeview. Those are the next nearest communities and districts. We also put in an addendum that if there are terrain under 30 miles that would prevent safe transportation. I don't know if any of you have been over Donnelly Grade between Mitchell and Spray. That's a significant barrier to transportation of students, along with life on the east side where you can have snow on the ground from November through March. Mm-hmm. You guys have got most of it on this side this year. It's been fairly dry for us, but on an average winter, we'll have snow for our vehicles a good portion of the winter.
Thank you. Do you have a follow-up?
Please. Thank you, Mr. Chair. When we look at remote and necessary, how many schools does that involve? Small schools. Do you have a number, Mark?
Sure. Thank you, Chair, Representative Dallin. The number we're looking at specifically in remote and necessary are 12. And again, they're all east side right now. I think there are some others that will be joining us with declining enrollment. The enrollment number we're really looking at is around 110 and under. There's a mathematical effect in the state school funding that makes it very, very challenging to fund schools with under 110 students. Even with the small schools correction, there aren't enough students to make the math work. And so what are these 12 districts have been forced to do over the last 5 years is to spend down any reserves they have, start, you know, eliminating things like your capital improvements budget. I have a building that was built in 1917. Some of the windows in my building are still of that vintage. In fact, the one in my office is, and I don't have the money in capital improvements to fix that. Our last major improvement was we had about $26,000 left in that fund. I think it was four summers ago. There were some leftover urgent school renovation dollars that were available, flow through from the Department of Ed, and they pitched in another $20,000. We were able to resurface the front of our building to keep the, you know, to keep pieces from falling off. So we have a wonderful building. We love it. I'd be hung somewhere in town if I tried to get rid of it. But it would, you know, those are just some of the things you do. You fix what you can. Right now our goal is to put one new door on a year and get new exterior doors in place. The old ones tend to blow open when the wind whistles through.
I think Representative Buckley had a question, and then if there isn't anything else pressing, I want to get to our other witness and give him a chance to testify as well. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Superintendent, I'd like to cram in two questions if I can on you, but hopefully they're related. First, why is it that the other schools listed don't follow your lead and become charter schools? Question number one. And number two, can you tell me, the bill has quite a list of things that you would still be, small schools would still be required to follow. Given what we're talking about, give me some examples of what they would not be required to follow if this bill should pass.
Chair Cannon, Representative Buckley, thank you. Excellent questions. I think one of the reasons that led us to go charter was the urgency of the situation. I mean, we were staring closure in the face, being new to the job, I visited the Department of Ed, and because I knew there was a vault of dollars there that they gave to districts in trouble like ours, because you just didn't close districts. That wasn't the nature of things. But they made it very clear that there was no vault of money, and in fact, I needed to come and speak to the legislature to find help. And that's what we've been doing now for the last 5.5 years. The other districts are moving to that same position as they continue to spend down the reserves to fill the gap between what we get and what the minimal it takes to operate. And charter starts with C right along with the word change, and that's a difficult thing. It's challenging to get people to move in ways sometimes. Very easy for my community for a lot of reasons. They're great people, and they understood the urgency of the situation, and so it was, I think, easier for us at that point. I have visited with both Spray and Fossil on this matter, and I'm sure I'll be visiting with some others as they move in that direction. And you had the other question. Oh, some examples. One of the things I used as an example with my community, and I have used in here as I've testified several times, when I took a list of cuts that we were going to have to make to keep our school open, one of the things was a certified librarian. My English teacher was my certified librarian, and I had a classified employee who had been doing the job for probably 10 years, very very knowledgeable. But as I slid that list of cuts across the table to the folks at the Department of Ed, they slid it back and said, if you do this, you're going to be out of compliance. And if you become non-standard for 1 year, you have to put together a plan to get yourself back in compliance. And what was keeping me out of compliance was lack of funding. And the only solution was I needed more funding, and I couldn't come up with a plan to give myself more money. In the second year, if you're out of compliance, the one of the possible punishments is they withhold all of your state school fund dollars, which was the very reason I was out of compliance to begin with. So we were really caught in that. Now, that legislation has since been changed, and I believe the if you can show that the reason that you're out of compliance is a funding shortfall, not of your own doing, that can be you can be given an extended timeline. Anyway, our part of our solution was to cut our English position to halftime and have her focus solely on English, and then and not have her do any librarian work, but allow the classified employee to do that work. That's what would have put us out of compliance, not the fact that we closed our cafeteria, that we'd cut our athletics salaries by half, which weren't big to begin with, not that we'd eliminated a significant number of our employees, but that rule dealing with the requirement to have a certified librarian. That's one example.
Thank you.
So,
Representative Cohn.
Thank you, Chair Cannon. Just a quick question. How much longer can you be a charter school to get this kind of money, or is your have you gleaned every dime out of this that you can already? To be so blunt, I can't think to do it any other way.
Chair Cannon, Representative Comp. Yeah, we have mined about all we can out of the charter grant dollars. There are three components to the, and it's federal grant dollars too. These aren't state dollars. The numbers have changed since we have gone through the process. But there are three components. An incentive grant that is, I think, somewhere between now $25,000 and $50,000 to help you work through the process of becoming charter. And then there are two more years after that of an amount of money. I don't know, again, when we went through it was $150,000 a year. And those are called implementation funds. And those are the dollars you spend to put the programs in place and fund those things, everything but salaries, to make the improvements and to make that change. We have used those dollars. I wrote a grant for dissemination. If you're alive after the end of your third year, they will allow you to write a grant to go out and explain what you're doing and to bring people in to see what you're doing. And that's currently what I'm involved in with the other remote and necessary districts. I've traveled, like I said, to several of those to kind of explain to their communities what we did, and we've brought some of their folks in to see what we're doing.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Rubin.
Thank you very much. You talked about a number of them, including your district, ran out of the reserves. So there was a time when you had reserves. There was a time when you had funding that was different. What is the big change there from your district standpoint that caused that to happen? Because the size of these schools has pretty much been pretty consistent for a long time.
Chair Cannon, Representative Roblin, yeah, I think the most significant is a long-term declining enrollment.
Okay.
Our district was actually one of the largest landmass districts at one time, and then I think it was 1989, it was before my time, our district split and became North Lake School District, which takes care of the communities of Silver Lake, Fort Rock, and Christmas Valley, and then Paisley, of course, which serves the communities of Summer Lake and Paisley. And about the same time, within the next year or two, our local mill closed and put us on a trend toward declining enrollment. Paisley's never been large by any means, but that loss of probably what had equaled at that time an enrollment drop of, you know, somewhere between 20 and 50 students initially, and then has since continued, and the fact that the unique nature of the community of Paisley, where we're surrounded by either federal lands or ranch land, there isn't a lot of room for growth within the district itself. So we have stabilized now. I think right now I have around 80 students K-12.
Follow up. So at one time, you had major receipts from timber funds.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, it was a significant portion of what we used. It's not the case now.
Yeah.
Representative Dell, and then I'll ask Mr. Jeffrey to stay up, so if in case after we hear Mr. Tarzian's testimony there's additional questions, he might be able to answer it as well.
Yes, Superintendent Jeffries, without the implementation grant money, would this bill be of assistance to those schools that are similarly situated to what you are? Does the bill have value with or without the grant?
Chair Cannon, Representative Dalm, I think as the bill is you know, listed using the term small schools, I think it has real value. The idea of giving our small schools the opportunity to use the flexibility available in this, you know, reduced regulatory involvement to find those efficiencies is really worthwhile. I think it in our case, I can tell you it's what keeps us going. It isn't going to keep us alive forever, but it keeps us going. The ability then at the local level to find those efficiencies to shift your staff as you have expertise available, those sort of things, to not have to have it. I'm very much in favor of certified librarians. I think they play an important role in every school, but I can't afford one. And yet under statute to be forced to have one that I cannot afford, which would be highly unlikely I could find, again, having somebody come to Paisley to work an hour or two a day is a bit unrealistic, I think, and we're finding that in other of our areas, but that's, I think, just a prime example. I think it'd have great value to all of Oregon's small districts to be held primarily accountable, and they are, by their local folks, to a standard that they can meet. I think it makes it much more efficient.
Thank you very much.
And thank you, Superintendent. And if you are able to stay at the dais and perhaps after our other witness speaks,
absolutely,
you can both answer questions that might emerge. And thank you for traveling the good distance that you did today to be here. Mr. Tarzan.
Chair Cannon and members of the committee, again, for the record, my name is Peter Tarzan. I'm the superintendent of Falls City School District. And I'm also the legislative committee chair for the Oregon Small Schools Association. I'm here to express our membership support for House Bill 2039. As you know, Oregon small schools and districts are numerous and are dispersed geographically throughout the state. So not only are we also talking about the very small and remote school districts on the east side of the mountains, but we're also talking about a large number of small school districts in southern Oregon, on the coast, and in the Willamette Valley. Depending on the yearly count, approximately 40 to 50% of Oregon's school districts have 1,500 students or less. And within those districts reside about 20 to 30% of the state's students. Most of these schools are in rural or isolated communities, and with few exceptions, all of these schools are served by small and or rural school districts. Their strengths are their lower class sizes, intimate learning environments, and close student-teacher and parent relationships. These schools, I believe, are the bedrock of their communities, and they are major contributors to the economic, social life for rural Oregon. In the post-Major 5 era that's now some 16 years old, Oregon public education, I think you would agree, has become far more complex and quite bureaucratized. Measure upon measure and rule upon rule comes down every day, and they are imposed on your school districts and your schools in the name of accountability and standards of performance. Most recently, No Child Left Behind has imposed upon the state an additional set of rules and regulations, which also those same small school districts are asked to perform under. No one in the small school community seriously debates the value of accountability and performance standards. House Bill 2039 clearly suggests that there are laws, standards, and practices that are very appropriate, and we would agree that their application should remain to small school districts. But what the legislation also does is it provides, as my colleague has said, for flexibility and innovation by taking inappropriately applied bureaucracy out of small school and district operations. Pattern after some of the same concepts embedded in the charter school legislation, House Bill 2039 provides for reviving greater support for your small school classrooms in lieu of the enormous bureaucratic nightmare that is becoming, quite frankly, a part of public school reality, large or small. So the Oregon Small Schools Association and its 110 member districts, that's 110 member districts out of 197 districts in the state, wholeheartedly endorse the basic concepts of this legislation. We have offered, and it's attached in the material that I provided you, an amendment, and it's really a technical one. It's in boldface in that print. I know that this is a public hearing, so that this is not a work session, that we believe would make the legislation workable for all the small elementary and high schools in the state. And let me explain. Falls City School District is a school district of 170 students. We have 109 students in our elementary school. Under the formula that's cited for eligibility as the bill is drafted, my elementary school would not be eligible for the provisions that are provided by this bill. And that's because it's within 8 miles of another elementary school, but in a different district. Now, long time ago when this legislation was passed, there was reason to try to convince school districts to consolidate. And so the way in which the legislation was written for the small and remote school funding bill was to say, if any elementary school is contiguous within a certain distance of another elementary school, then they would not be eligible for that correction. And I'm simply suggesting that we, in this legislation, somehow we stipulate that if it's a that the limitation would apply if the elementary schools were contiguous within the same district. If they were not contiguous within the same district, but rather in different districts, then they would be eligible under the proposed legislation. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Dr. Tarzian. Are there questions for either of the witnesses? Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Tarzian, can I ask you the same question that I asked the superintendent? Can you give me some examples? Is this basically personnel-based in terms of the flexibility that you'd be looking for with the changes to the restrictions being lifted? Is it the ability to be flexible with personnel? Is it the ability to have fewer reports to the state? What exactly are you looking for with this?
Well, Chair Cannon, Representative Buckley, I'd like to draw your attention to, I think, another sheet that you have here. It represents the reporting requirements for all school districts. I had my staff copy it off the web.
Mm-hmm.
What the legislation would do, I'll give you an example. The Dallas School District has a full-time staff member who is responsible for all government programs, both federal and state. My staff of one, that would be me.
How's that staff doing today? Yeah.
You know, and the wonderful volunteers that help us in our schools are also responsible for completing all of the same information. I also provided you with a sheet that shows what our current graduation requirements are for Falls City School District. And if you go down that list, I hope you will be impressed that we are not asking to dumb down our public school systems in rural communities. Most of, if not all, of our members, you know, have very rigorous graduation requirements. But to answer your question, what it will do is provide a freed up staff time, especially at the building principal level, to support teachers, provide day-to-day staff development support for our teaching staff, to be able to spend more time assessing the progress of students as a building leader, and to work with their staff to address the particular skill deficiencies that students may have. And so what this legislation would do for us is it would free us up from a lot of bureaucratic work, quite frankly, that is just becoming enormous. I've been a superintendent in Falls City since 1999. The workload has quadrupled from the time that I arrived. And quite frankly, I'll give you an example of the way in which the federal No Child Left Behind requirements are slowly but surely working their way into the reality for non-federal fund receiving schools. You're familiar with special education, children with learning disabilities. Those children have in the past had the opportunity to be able to test down. They no longer have the opportunity to test down. So this is a clear, you know, kind of transition in the state without really any regulatory support for the State Department to require that all students test at their grade level regardless of their learning disability. We now buy private testing services so that we can use those tests to inform instruction and help those students with disabilities continue to improve.
Other questions?
Chair.
Yeah, Representative Gump.
Thanks, Chair Cannon. Some of us are very interested in looking at a data system to ensure that all students are learning. And with your report you have here about all the reports that you have to submit, how many different databases are you working out of?
Well, actually, several. Two. I'm sorry, Chair Cannon, Representative Comp. Because we are members of the Lynn Benton Lincoln Education Service District database, and so we provide all of our student data into that database, and the State Department has access to that database. And so all of the other reports that we have to provide as well many times seems for many superintendents to be duplications. We would love to have the state have one database that we could just all simply put our information into and not have to do anything else, because this takes an incredible amount of staff time to meet all of these reporting requirements.
Okay, so you have the one database, follow-up, Chair?
Yes.
Thank you, I'm sorry. You have the one database that has, you know, some information. You said you had two. What was your second database? One from Lynn Benton and...
Our second database is one that we have bought, Chair Cannon, I expected Representative Comp to be the chair. Thrown me off here.
Sorry.
Chair Cannon, Representative Comp. We also use the Northwest Education Association's what they call MAPS assessment database. And that's a database that actually resides in NWEA, and we use that to specifically inform instruction on a monthly basis. So we look at where students are, we test our students, and then we change how we're approaching certain students that are weak in particular strands in either math or language arts.
Okay. Follow-up, Chair?
Yep.
Thank you. Is all your assessment data then in the MAPS database? Because you have several assessment pieces on here.
Chair Cannon, Representative Tom, between the two databases, that is all of our assessment data for our students.
So some may fall within one database or the other.
Well, Chair Cannon, Representative Comp, actually, the data that we put into the LBL system is data that is required by the state.
Correct.
The data that we utilize NWEA maps for is data that we use to inform instruction and kind of change how we're dealing with particular weaknesses with particular groups of students.
So one last comment, not necessarily a question, and maybe it can be a question. So listening, can I deduct that the required stuff that the state asked from Lynn Benton database doesn't inform instruction?
Chair Cannon, Representative Comp, it is not used to inform instruction.
Thank you.
All right. Well, not seeing any other questions, thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
And I'll call the next couple of witnesses, Tom Byerly and Margaret DeLacy. Come on up. Please state your name for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tom Byerly. I'm Assistant Director for Unemployment Insurance for the Employment Department. I'm here to offer some testimony on House Bill 2039, and I pray that I'm not viewed as the torpedo to the bill, but we are requesting that the Employment Department's Chapter 657, be added to the list of exceptions. Our chapter, the Employment Department Law, Chapter 657, basically covers unemployment insurance for workers. And the Federal Unemployment Tax Act requires that we treat employees in certain classifications equally across the state. And to exclude small schools from that puts us out of compliance with federal law and would result in jeopardizing our administrative funding of about $94 million a year, and also remove our FUTA tax credit for Oregon employers to the tune of about $1.04 billion per biennium. When I suggest adding this chapter to the list, I would also suggest that it would not be a large fiscal impact to small schools to add that, because small schools reimburse the trust fund when benefits are claimed. And it's been my experience in 25 years in unemployment insurance that small school districts don't have a large turnover. They're great places to work. And so I hope those costs are low. Maybe the people that have testified earlier would say otherwise. But I don't think it's a huge impact. But unfortunately, it does create a problem for us in the Federal Employment Tax Act as far as conformity goes. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Representative Dallin.
Presently, are charter schools exempt? And what's the number of the law you're speaking of?
It's chapter Oregon Revised Statute, Chapter 657. Chair Cannon, Rep. Dallin, I don't think charter schools are exempt from our chapter either. I don't think they could be. We'd be in a federal conformity issue with that as well.
You're probably following.
I think we're. I'm not
are they,
sure.
Are they? I'm sorry.
I don't believe they are either, but I don't know. But
I'll go back and check. I apologize.
And I think we should know that, because if we do have a charter school expert in the room.
Are they not teachers, though?
Yes.
Yeah. And I'm going to ask, will you be at the dais? And I'm referring for the benefit of those that are listening and watching by other media. I'm talking to Jim Green. Will you be testifying on this bill? I want to get to the bottom of this because...
For our purpose, Mr. Chair, I'll go back and get that information for the committee. I apologize.
And if you would please send that information to our committee administrator, and he'll make sure that it gets in the hands of committee members.
Certainly.
I believe this bill would simply give small schools the option to become in word and deed a charter. And if charters are exempt from this rule, I mean, if these schools would be exempt, then charters are, because they're like quantities. So I think perhaps, I think we're going to get to the bottom of it.
I apologize for not being prepared for that question.
Are there any other questions for this witness? All right, thanks. And go ahead. State your name for the record, please.
Okay. Good afternoon. My name is Margaret DeLacy. I'm here from Portland, Oregon, and I'm testifying on this bill on behalf of the Oregon Association for Talented and Gifted. This bill, House Bill 2039, would in effect repeal the TAG mandate for rural schools. Charters are currently exempt, and it has caused some problems for parents in some of these rural areas that have no choice but to attend a charter. It's often a big challenge to provide TAG services to rural students, but it can be done, and it can be done very effectively. And one of your handouts is a newsletter from Duke on both problems and solutions to providing TAG services in rural schools. And I think you heard from Superintendent Jeffries, was it, earlier today, that there are rural schools who do a good job with gifted students. I don't think we should give up on these students simply because they're in small communities. In addition, technology, particularly distance learning, is making it easier and not harder than it has been in the past to provide appropriate instruction to every student. Other rural states, particularly Iowa, have very strong TAG programs. Iowa has made providing rural TAG services a priority, and the Bell and Blank Center for Gifted Development is located in Iowa. This bill may further harm rural communities instead of helping them as intended. For example, one of the reasons that it's very difficult to recruit highly educated young professionals, such as doctors, to rural areas is that many of these professionals set a very high value on their education. Most of them made sacrifices themselves to obtain their education, and they want to provide a similar quality of education for their children. Doctors and other young professionals hesitate to settle in rural areas because they worry about the education that their children are going to receive in small rural schools. For example, a flyer for women doctors considering a rural practice advises them to investigate child care and schooling options in this community before taking the job, end quote. And it advises rural communities to, quote, determine and make available information regarding high-quality child care and schools in your community. If resources are unavailable or inadequate, think about what your community can do to improve these resources, unquote. A former president of the Association of American Medical Colleges has commented that in rural settings, professional isolation, lack of employment opportunities for one's spouse, limited educational opportunities for one's children, and a paucity of satisfying cultural and civic outlets naturally enter the calculation when young physicians weigh their practice options. Yet it's been estimated that the economic impact of just one rural physician, and I'm just talking about physicians as an example of the problem that these small communities have in attracting professionals at this level, the impact of one rural doctor is about $1 million and 17 jobs each and every year. That's not just because of the people that a given doctor employs, but because other employers, you heard about a factory closing, are very reluctant to move into communities that can't provide their employees with health care or with adequate educational services. A report from the U.S. Department of Agriculture found that the higher the level of educational attainment in small rural communities, the faster the growth rates in both per capita income and employment in those communities. And it also found that students in rural schools that offer advanced coursework and have more qualified and better paid teachers score higher on standardized math and reading tests. Rural students who obtain professional training are more likely to return to rural areas than urban students are. That's where their family is. That's often where their heart is. Why should we cripple these rural high-achieving students and make it harder for them to become prepared for professions such as medicine, veterinary care, pharmacy, a lot of other professional positions that are very important to rural communities but require a high level of education? Strong TAG programs are one indication and an indication that members of the public look for that schools are committed to meeting the needs of every child, even their high-achieving children. If Oregon announces that it does not expect rural schools to challenge every child, if we agree that it's too hard for smaller schools to provide services to high-achieving students, it will become even more difficult to recruit doctors and other young professional workers to these communities. Excellent education is often, by far, the best economic investment that a rural community can make, and TAG services are an essential component of that education. We believe that every child, even a child in a rural school, and as you've heard, that's a lot of the schools in our state, every child has a right to an education that meets that child's needs and prepares him for the future, him or her for the future. I don't see why we should tell any of our children that they need to settle for less, or to tell the rest of the world that we only expect our rural schools to achieve mediocrity. Thank you very much. I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Dallin, question?
Yes, when you use the term, where did you tell us when you identified yourself, where you live?
I come from Portland.
From Portland. When you say rural, would you define rural for me?
I am using the definition that was used in the bill.
And small the same? But I think the application comes out a little different. Because I just was involved in trying to attract physicians to the Dalles, neither rural nor small. And education is an issue, but we're talking about Paisley. I don't think Paisley's ever had a physician. We're talking about Spray. I don't think they have a lawyer. We're talking about Mitchell. I don't think they have a doctor or lawyer. I think they struggle to share a thief. And when we identify rural, I think you're much larger than what this bill is directed at. Mm-hmm. But we just don't have professionals. We just don't have them at all. And would be delighted to have them. But I don't want to, but I think you have to understand the setting when Superintendent Jeffries talked about the area that his district serves. It's the size of some small eastern states. So I think we have a different concept of what rural and urban is. And I'd want that to be clear, that we understand that definition.
This isn't just a remote.
Do you want to respond to that, or is there a question?
I guess the question, I asked the question, and you did answer what small rural means.
Chair Cannon, Representative Dellum, I would maintain that even in a area that is the size of a state and is too small to share a thief, students are still entitled to appropriate instruction at their level and rate of learning, and that is what the TAG bill requires schools to provide. I think we send a very poor signal to the rest of the country if we say we're going to give up on these schools and not require them to provide appropriate instruction for every child.
Thank you very much.
Are there any more questions?
Any other questions? All right. Thank you very much. Is there anyone else here to testify on House Bill 2039? All right. Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2039 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2038. And call to the dais Representative Dellum to kick us off here.
Thank you, Chairman Cannon. Thank you, members of the committee. Thank you all. I'm a little perplexed. I was asked to testify very early, but I want to give you some history on 2038.
Representative, I ask you to identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. I'm still reeling a bit from this testimony piece. Representative John Dellum, House District 59.
And just to clarify, I think we have you testifying first because you are here supporting it, and we wanted to make sure someone had the opportunity to explain and defend this bill before we move on to other witnesses.
Thank you. I want to get that.
And take your time.
Thank you very much.
Can the administrator have a chance to
explain? Oh, sorry. Why don't we do that?
Sure. Let me just, and I'll, thank you, Chair. I'll just briefly describe what the bill does. It does repeal the limitation on the total credit hours that may be awarded each school year to students who participate in the Expanded Options Program, or EOP. This was a bill that came out of the 2005 session, Senate Bill 300, that enacted the Expanded Options Program. This is for eligible students in grades 11 and 12 to have additional options to continue or complete education, earn concurrent high school, college credits, gain early entry into post-secondary education, et cetera. To be eligible, a student must have an approved educational learning plan on file with their high school and must not have received a high school diploma. Basically, ORS 340.080, which is repealed,
stipulates that for a high school with an enrollment of 1,000 students each school year, no more than 330 credit hours may be awarded to each eligible student. For schools above below 1,000 students, those are set by rules in terms of credit hours. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. And now you.
Thank you, Chair Ken. I think we'll get this right between the two of us. Last session, Senator Abel Gordley and myself talked about making access for several groups of students to the community college system, the university system. And really, our plan was any system that provided an alternative education program for kids, in some cases that were disenchanted and gone, dropouts, those that had left the system, and even in some cases, those that needed more than the local school district could offer, either socially, academically. We didn't really concern ourselves with what happened. As a result, a group of the present players, the School Board Association, the community colleges, anyone that had an interest in the bill came together, and they drafted Senate Bill 300. That was a long task. My observations were mostly vicarious, but so was Senator Gordley. And when the bill was over, one of the things that troubled us, and there were several things in the bill that we thought perhaps should be fixed, and one was the limit on the number of credits that a student could earn. We had originally envisioned a bill for the student that stayed in a resident of their high school, of perhaps graduating in 2 years with an associate degree, and we dreamed big, and a high school diploma at the same time. I'm sure that would have been very much an exception to the rule and not happened often, but we wanted to design a system that would allow that to happen. I don't want to speak for Senator Gordley, but I think she was looking for those students that had become disenchanted and wanted to offer them an opportunity to come into the system a different way. Her and I, in our conversations, our reckoning was that the people that she was dealing with had failed at the high school, and it didn't matter for what reason, and we weren't looking to assign blame. What we were looking for is a way to bring these people back into the system. And we had a fairly sound notion that when we brought them back in the system, to bring them back into the place where they had repeatedly failed would be, again, less than successful. So we wanted to offer, if you will, a change of venue, a new opportunity, a new chance. Well, as we examined Senate Bill and 300 at that time, one of the first issues that concerned us was the credit cap. In my own experience, having done work with this, very similar to this, with Lynn Denton Community College 15 years ago, 12 years ago, probably 30 years ago, time goes by so quickly, we did not find that we exceeded or that we lost dramatically from the Central Lynn School District. In fact, we discovered that we found kids we didn't know we had. And so our first order of business was to remove this credit cap. And for that reason, this bill does that, and I would ask you to support this bill. It also moves us closer to providing a seamless education for our students. If you drop to the ground and look at the prism of education from the student's vantage point, it is indeed silos, and very tall silos. Silos that are impenetrable. And this bill gives them an option, an opportunity, to move as a student outside of the system and find another way. And removing credit caps, I think, would be a boon to the students. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative. And perhaps hang on and we'll see if there are any questions. Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, you talked about the other options besides, you know, the idea of getting an associate degree while still in high school. What are some of the options that you were looking for the students who had become disenchanted?
Again, I can speak from my own experience, and we don't have numbers yet on Senate Bill 300 to tell you exactly. And I believe that was part of the original bill, was to keep and record the information the students found. But your question, what we found is that students came from all walks of life. And this was a past experience. We had a young a young student from a neighboring school district that was one credit short and couldn't graduate on time. Well, when I talked to John Carnahan and we accepted that student into our district, we were able to handle that English credit in a host of ways. The issue was, did this child have mastery of English? And if you recall, the original Oregon Education Act, the beauty of the act, what it did, it asked, what does the child know? It did not ask, how long did the child sit in the chair? And so for that reason, and I could cite example after example of where being able to move a little more freely between the silos offers all students another venue. We did have students that graduated from Central Lynn with 2 degrees at the same time. It was amazing. It wasn't many. I can cite other examples of students that did not want to take advantage of the program. They were involved in student government, athletics, social events, the daily business of going to school and meeting your best friends at your locker. Okay. There was no interest from them. But I think if there is interest, we ought not to be creating an artificial cap and saying to some students, you because you signed up first may go. You because you signed up second or were found last may not. And that's the problem that I have with the artificial barrier, is we could put ourselves in a position where we deny a student, not because we don't have the facilities or the money. I think there's a little bickering about the money, but that can be resolved. But we deny a student because an institution wants to hold that student captive to what they own, to what they lay claim to. And certainly I understand that. But let's reverse the position and look at our school system, pre-K to 20, from the eyes of the child and give them every opportunity we can to succeed. Please, that answers the question. I might get a little passionate about this.
Any other questions? I guess mine would be that... Go ahead, Representative.
You can go ahead.
Well, I was just going to ask the statute, I presume from the bill, Senate Bill 305 or 300, does require the Department of Education to report annually on the program. Did you allude to that report?
Yes, I did. And in the interim, now that report may be ready now. But I know that on the Interim Committee on Education, they had just started collecting the data, and I'm not sure that they had it collated or ready to present. I might ask our chair to ask for that information, or your chair, or would you, Mr. Chair? But at the time that the Interim Committee met, we did not have that information available.
Representative Cobb.
Thanks, Representative Chair Cannon. The question you asked is exactly where my mind was going. Because I have no idea whether we could, first of all, how many students have been impacted? Have any school district run out of options because of the cap? And, I really would like to find out what the numbers are.
Yeah, I think we should ask the Department of Education for that report if it's available, and if not, find out when
why
it will
not?
Be and why it isn't.
You know, I'd like to have it within 2 weeks. I'm sorry, I'm being very assertive.
I think that's your prerogative. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee.
All right. Call up, please, Chuck Bennett, Jim Green, and Lori Wimmer Whalen. You can take it in any order you like.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. For your record, Lori Wimmer Whalen with the Oregon Education Association, here today to speak with all due respect in opposition to this bill on behalf of our 46,000 members. We participated in the work group on this bill last session, and the proposal before you deletes an essential piece of the compromise that our coalition worked up as we looked at how to make this work for the students of Oregon who choose these expanded options, as well as for the students of Oregon who choose the traditional program, because, of course, school districts have to walk a line in terms of financial balance with respect to offering the best programs they can for all kids. And so while we think about the opportunities we want to provide for kids who would like to do concurrent credit programs, we also have to think about the kids who are in the traditional program as well, and what kinds of decisions have to be made with respect to managing money, particularly as we've lost $1.2 billion since 1999 in K-12. We have been working on this bill actually since it was first introduced in 1999, so this will be our fifth biennium looking at this concept. And we also have a bill on the Senate side, which I hope is winging its way to you, that is a work product of the coalition as we came back together again in the interim. Harvey Matthews, then of AOI, was kind of the convener of our coalition during the interim, and the Department of Ed, Higher Ed, community colleges, and all of the K-12 community all participated so that we could fix a drafting error, as it was characterized, with respect to the financial waivers piece of the bill. That was put in the cap section rather than applying to the entire program as we had all signed off on. So that and a couple other reporting and timing issues that districts had told us would be helpful. For example, when a student moves into a district later in the year beyond the deadline and might want to participate, there was a hope that we could get that student into the program even though the deadlines had been exceeded and give the student the opportunity to sign up belatedly. That's a fix that we thought ought to go in just to expand the program more. So there are things on both sides of it that we are looking at and are in the bill. I don't have a bill number for you. It's still in LC draft form, but I'm sure it will be out imminently, and it's our hope that you'll be seeing it soon. And so from our perspective, this bill seeks to eliminate a critical component of our original agreement in a way that isn't going to be helpful with all of our coalition work, both up to the point of its passage in 05 and also since then. And so we would like very much for this to be the end of its legislative journey, with all due respect, because we believe that the other bill actually will fix the bill in a way, I mean the law in a way, that the coalition can support. Thank you.
All right, and perhaps we'll hear from all three of you before going to questions. Whoever's up.
Who's up?
Mr. Chairman, my name is Chuck Bennett. I represent the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. Mr. Chairman, as Ms. Wimmer Whalen mentioned, this issue has been in front of the legislature for a number of sessions. And we began working last session with Senator Gordley on this, became convinced that this really represents a direction in that kind of P20 concept, and that we were really getting underway with Senate Bill 300. And I think our organization played a pivotal role in helping put together the working group that developed Senate Bill 300. We are very excited about the opportunities here. The problem, I think, with what is proposed in this bill, And we get as passionate about it, I think, as Representative Dallum. We support this concept wholeheartedly. But Senate Bill 300 was a way to put this on the road to happening. We had thousands of students already being served by 2+2 programs and other kinds of programs that integrated high school and college, community college opportunities. What we didn't have was a statutory structure that picked up all the other students that didn't have these kind of contracted opportunities. And it took a lot of work to put together Senate Bill 300 last time. As in any kind of legislation that is worked through, there are misunderstandings. But what wasn't misunderstood, and I have to say that it was very much the work of Senator Avell Gordley and her staff that kept us focused on the prize on this issue. We were able to produce this bill and include in it the opportunity to collect data to put to rest both the realities and the myths of what's going to happen in K-12 and in community colleges and where students will go, what students, the impact on small schools, a whole variety of issues that had come up over the previous sessions where this was discussed. To pass this bill would be to intrude on that opportunity to collect that data, to continue the kind of agreement and structural changes that are evolving fairly rapidly out there. And that's why we would ask you to look at the bill that comes from the Senate. It comes out of the same kind of work group. It comes with the same kinds of broad agreements. And allow this process to continue, although we certainly agree with the sentiment, if not the outright demand from Representative Comp, that we get some numbers here in the next couple of weeks. And it'd be very nice to have the data that we ask for in Senate Bill 300 so we could answer the questions that are really at hand here. With that in mind, we'd ask you to forestall action on this bill, take a look at the Senate bill when it comes through, and please continue to press the Department of Education for this data. We really do need to see what happened in the Senate Bill 300 structure so that we can, again, get back together and work our way further through this, bringing everyone along together. And that would be our hope with this piece of legislation as well as legislation coming out of the Senate. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Jim Green representing the Oregon School Boards Association. I'd echo what my colleagues have said here at the table. One of the other things I would say is I think the bill's a little bit premature, and I'd go along with what Mr. Bennett has said, because you need to take a look at what we included in Senate Bill 300 last time, and I think Representative Buckley hit the nail right on the head when he mentioned the report, because in ORS Chapter 340.085, there's a report due to the legislature from the Department of Education, and that report includes in subsection 9 recommendations for changes to the expanded options program to better serve students. If that's one of the recommendations, let's take a look at it. But I think this thing's only been on the books since last session. It's only been implemented since the Department of Education adopted administrative rules partway through the interim, and we're just in the first school year. Let's see where we're at and what type of programs and kids we're serving here. The other point I'd make is this is an expanded option program that allows the money to follow the kid. There are hundreds upon hundreds of other programs in our school districts across the state that already allow this to occur. In 2003, when we looked at this piece of legislation, we had an excess of 26,000 students in this state participating in these programs. And I can speak from personal experience. When I graduated from Sprague High School here in the Salem-Keizer School District, I graduated with 29 hours of college credit already because of the agreement they had with Chemeketa Community College. And those are going on all over the state. What we found and why we created Senate Bill 300 was that not all school districts had that. And in small rural school districts, there was concerns about the ability and access for kids to get that. Part of the report from the Oregon Department of Education is to address those issues. And I'd hope you would wait on this bill until you see that report. And I urge you, along with Representative Comp, to get that report as soon as you can. We're all waiting for that report as well. And I would echo what Ms. Wimmer Whalen said. We were part of the work group that served this interim trying to make some changes to it, because as we got back from last session, took a look at Senate Bill 300, there were some technical problems with it. The department had some issues they needed fixed. Community colleges had some issues they needed fixed. The state system of higher ed had some issues they needed fixed. That's what that bill's going to take a look at as it comes over from the Senate side. Are there still disagreements at the table? Yeah, there's still disagreements at the table. And we're going to have those discussions and those debates during this legislative session. But I would urge you to wait on this piece of legislation. Let's take a look at that report and see who we're not serving and how we can serve them better.
Thank you. Are there questions for this panel? Representative Kump.
Thank you. And I hadn't planned on making any of these comments, much less demands, but I want to thank you for your work and Representative Dahlem for bringing these types of things to the table. This committee has spent the last month or so, and it seems like what we've done is bring a tremendous amount of problems to this dais and to this body. And one of those common features in every one of those things, as I'm sitting here reflecting, is a report a lack of a report data. We heard another example was last week when we heard about the new pilot for the education service districts. We had several lengthy reports by outside auditing about that bill with some strong recommendation. And the first recommendation is that the Oregon Department of Education require reports from the ESDs. I mean, we are in a backward spin. That is unbelievable. A gymnast couldn't keep up with which report's supposed to be moving forward and which one's moving backwards. And I don't know what the solution is, but I know every representative here and constituent, including Margaret, you know, concern about our talented and gifted children who have the least amount of funds in our state. You know, we've got to come together with something, because this is another clear instance of a great legislated bill that we don't know how we can correct it or improve it. And I would just, again, plead to all of us to keep our thinking hats on, and we're going to need to figure out a way to make sure we get the information we need to have good decisions.
Any questions? I guess I have one, which is if, let's say this report comes back and it turns out that there are more students who would like to take advantage of this expanded options program than is allowable under the cap, do you have thoughts on whether, in that case, this bill would be necessary or would do more harm than good?
Mr. Chair, I'll take a stab at that, because I think the OEA really did lead on the issue of trying to consider the Financial Balancing Act that I referred to earlier. And both the waiver opportunity and the caps were ways for us to make sure that it was a controlled experiment, at least in the early years. And so all of the data should probably be taken together to know. But we would also look at the overall financial health of Oregon's K-12 system and determine whether or not we're serving all kids, including in this kind of program. And as Mr. Green just told you, before this was even enacted, 26,000 students were, I think I said 22,000 in my written testimony, I was off by four, but had already been involved in various different programs that offer concurrent credit. And one of the problems that we are having and need to fix, of course, is that where there is an adverse financial impact to individual districts, we need to make sure that there is an ability to get a waiver. And with the waivers in place properly drafted, we think that maybe we'll be okay. The caps, though, were a way to start modestly, see what the needs are, really work to get at-risk kids at the head of the line, so that they would have access to a program that maybe in a way that was different from how other kids were accessing the other programs that were more voluntary in nature, some of which required some parent co-pays and that sort of thing. My own son takes an extended studies program, and so I know that some of them do involve parents having to put some money on the table. So this one contemplated something different, no money coming from the family for those students who wouldn't be able to afford it. Long way of saying, caps for now seem like a reasonable thing to do, particularly given that we're not funding schools adequately yet. But once all of those issues can be resolved, perhaps there'll be no need.
Mr. Chairman, I guess I'd answer it along the same lines, but a little bit different twist. I'd want to see the data and how it broke down from those school districts who had more than 1,000 students, those high schools that had more than 1,000 and had less than 1,000. Because I'd want to see how that data broke out. And that was one of the whole ideas behind the bill, is those school districts that weren't offering it. And we heard that most of those were our small rural schools because of just where they happen to be located. I'd want to see that data. The other thing that you don't see in this bill, because you don't get to see ORS Chapter 340.080, the statute there, is we put a provision in there that allows school districts to exceed that cap if they want to. And I'd want to see whether any school districts had exceeded that cap, because there is a provision in that part of the statute that even if they hit that cap, that school district can go beyond it if they want to serve those kids that way. And I'd want to know the data on that. And I know you're going to hear from the woman who was up here testifying on the previous bill for Talented and Gifted, and she's going to make some comments. One of the other parts of the report
also requires to report on the number of talented and gifted students served by this. I think there's a lot of data that we need to see on this. You as a legislature, are requiring school districts to make data-driven decisions now as it relates to student achievement. And I think you as a legislature, when you look at this program, need to make data-driven decisions as well.
A quick follow-up.
Yep.
Chair Cannon, Ms. Whalen, can you tell us who you worked with about this bill at Oregon Department of Education so we have a name of somebody we might be able to contact just to help us get the report?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Comp, Salam Noor was one of the members of the coalition.
Thank you. That's very helpful.
Thank you. All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. And invite Margaret DeLacy back up, please. And your name again for the record.
My name is Margaret DeLacy, and for this bill, I'm here on my own behalf, not that of the OTAG organization. May I address a couple of the questions before I begin?
Absolutely.
First of all, Chair Cannon and Representative Comp, the report that's mentioned in Senate Bill 300 is due in 2008, January 1st, 2008, I believe is the date. I actually have a copy of the bill here, and I could look it up for you if you like.
Thank you.
And
well, we might try to bump that up.
Second, in Washington State, which has had Running Start for a long time, approximately 10% of the eligible students participate. That will give you some idea of the level of the demand. I think that you have a Running Start report in the packet I'm just handing out. Okay, I'll begin.
Thank you.
I'm here today. I'm completely with Representative Dellum on this in support of House Bill 2038. I was a member of the work committee, not the one that's been meeting this session, but the one that wrote the bill that passed last session. And at the time on the work committee, I strongly opposed the stringent limitation in the bill on the number of students who could participate in any given high school. The cap is approximately 9 full-time participants for a high school of 1,000 students. And as I just told you, about 10% of the students in eligible students in Running Start want to participate. So the cap is a lot lower than the number of students who are participating in other states, including neighboring states with similar demographics. In addition, I objected then, and I still object strongly, to the limitation on the age of participating students. They have to be older than 16, and on the non-duplication clauses, partly because I believe the non-duplication clause is ambiguous and hard to interpret. During the 2 years since the expanded options bill passed, the arguments against these unnecessary limits on student participation have only become stronger because the evidence in favor of dual credit programs, such as the one created by Senate Bill 300, has actually increased. It's not absolutely overwhelming yet, but it has only increased in the past 2 years. I'm providing a copy of some of the reports I reviewed before testifying today, and if anybody's interested, I also have one set of the printouts of some of the material I read for that. I'd be happy to provide this copy or email a copy or mail a copy if anybody wants to see some of these additional reports. I didn't want to overwhelm you guys. Here are some excerpts from the material that I looked at. The Education Commission on the States produced a policy brief on dual and concurrent enrollment that came out last March of 2006. Comments that a growing body of research documents the benefits of dual enrollment. According to the U.S. Department of Education, college credits earned prior to high school graduation reduce the average time to degree and increase the likelihood of graduation. Recent research in Minnesota suggests that the number of students taking advanced placement tests rose tenfold between 1986 and 2004 as a result of the state's dual enrollment program. There's evidence that dual enrollment increases academic performance and educational attainment. Contrary to what you've been hearing from the Department of Education on the strides we've made in advanced placement, I might add that we have a very, very low rate of participation in advanced placement in this state. I believe that we're 40th among the states right now. We're 32 the last time I compiled the information, so we've fallen quite a ways. A study in Arizona found that students who had participated in transition programs of
this sort experience lower drops in their grade point averages during their freshman year than other students, and the author suggested that this difference indicated a positive impact on college success stemming from participation in AP or dual enrollment programs. That particular study was adjusted for socioeconomic status and family income. The Running Start 2005-06 Annual Progress Report found that the program in Washington served about 10% of high school juniors and seniors. It saved Washington taxpayers $43.8 million and families $27.5 million for a total of more than $71.3 million. You heard from Ms. Wimmer-Whalen that she's very concerned about the financial health of the schools. I can't understand why she wouldn't want to increase participation in a program that saved the state of Washington over $70 million education dollars. That is money that we can use more productively in other places in our education system. Running Start students outperformed other matched recent graduates who are attending college now. These reports show that dual credit programs do not displace such programs as advanced placement. You've heard about some of the other programs that are available in the state. There's no reason to think that this would undermine similar opportunities for other students. They resulted in significantly increased AP participation, something that we badly need here. They saved huge amounts of money. $70 million is half the $141 million that we are losing in the timber credits this year. That's a lot of money. Now, we're a smaller state than Washington, so we couldn't expect to save that much money, but it's still a lot of potential savings. They increase student learning and student performance and increase the chances that a student will graduate from college. Furthermore, participating students and their families are extremely, extremely satisfied with these programs. Wherever they've looked, satisfaction rates are up in the high 90s. Finally, there are a number of Oregon laws that commit us to fostering and recognizing student excellence, to providing additional and alternative educational options for students who exceed all standards at grades 3, 5, 8, and 10, and to providing appropriate instruction to our identified TAG students, who today constitute about 8% of our student participation. Arbitrary limits on students' opportunities to participate are not in keeping with these commitments that you, as legislators, have made to our students. In these tight budget times, we very seldom have an opportunity to make significant improvements in education, particularly at the high school level, and the high school level is the level at which improvement is most needed. In this case, we can not only improve education, but save money for taxpayers and students. To retain arbitrary and unnecessary limits on student participation is simply wasteful. Thank you very much. I'd be happy to entertain any questions.
Thank you. Questions?
All right.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who's here to testify on House Bill 2038? All right. Seeing nobody, then I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2038, and this committee is adjourned.
Excellent. Thank you very much.